Coming to you from fabulous Las Vegas, Nevada, this is the Jug Life Podcast with Chad Wesley Smith and Max Ada. Hey everybody, this is another episode of the Jug Life Podcast. I'm Chad Wesley Smith, joined as always by the notorious M-A-X, Max Montana, and our guest today, the Director of Strength and Conditioning at the UFC Performance Institute here in Las Vegas, Mr. Bo Sandoval. Bo, how you doing?
Great, thanks for having me.
All right. Just to kind of jump right into things, well, first, our episode today is brought to you by Ab Crunches and Kidney Punches. It's a lifestyle. And let's just jump right in and kind of get to know you, your own athletic background, coaching background, and what brought you here to Vegas and the UFC?
Sure. You know, growing up, I grew up in the South, Louisiana, Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and played just about every sport as a kid traditionally that Americans play. So soccer, baseball, football, basketball, track and field. On through high school, primarily football and track and field. And track and field is probably where I started to get exposed to formal training the most, at least an understanding that there are periodic plans in place. And so at the time, I mean, LSU was a powerhouse in track and field, and a buddy of mine that I played high school football with, his dad had coached with that staff for a little while, which who's the guy that's at IMG now that ran the Velocity performances?
Lauren Seagrave.
Lauren Seagrave was the head coach there at the time. So not only did we get to go watch meets, but getting the kind of behind-the-scenes look from that gentleman and also an understanding what some of those different event groups were doing in preparation, I was like, wow, that's, you know, really cool. Definitely not at the point where I was identifying, hey, I'm going to be a strength coach.
Was Dan Papp at LSU at that time as well?
I want to say he had just left. Someone else asked me that question before, but I believe he had just – actually, Dan might have asked me that. I went out and visited those guys at Altus a couple of years ago. But I believe he had just left. He wasn't there anymore. But so that got me interested. In college, I didn't know what I wanted to do. I was like every other kid, you know, I wanted to get out of my house, but I didn't know where I wanted to go. I ended up in Northwestern State, Louisiana, in North Louisiana. And
one of my buddies is the throws coach there now.
Really?
Yeah. Yes. You would know. I mean Nick Farr.
Oh, Amin's there. Yeah, I had no idea he was at Northwestern.
Yeah,
because he was at Southeastern.
I might have my directions mixed up.
I think he's at Southeastern.
He's had a bunch of directions.
He is at Southeastern, Louisiana. And he's done a tremendous job there. I mean, he went to a program that was, I would say, struggling a little bit.
Yeah.
And had some national contenders year one. So
national champion, the weight throw.
I didn't want to misquote, but yeah, I think you're right. So I started at Northwestern State, didn't know what I wanted to do, applied for an on-campus job. They stuck me out at the softball and baseball fields cutting grass.
Now, is Northwestern State, is that where Bobby Boucher played? Or
possibly. I don't know. He might have been the president of the university. We were well hydrated there, that's all I know. But they stuck me out at the softball fields cutting grass. And about 2 weeks into that, the head softball coach had approached me and asked me if I wanted to do a paid gig being an equipment manager. And I was like, yeah, you know, that's more weekend beer money. So sure, I'll do that. And so I did that. A couple weeks into it, I started noticing the team going down to the weight room to do some organized strength training. So I asked the head coach if I could tag along and watch. That turned into me asking the head strength coach, who was Thad Livingston at the time, if I could just peek in. He's like, yeah, no problem. So I started kind of watching that, and then I watched some of the other teams do some training. And I was like, this is pretty cool. I didn't have no idea you could make a living doing something like that. I'd heard of personal training and stuff before, but nothing in a collegiate sporting setting or anything like that. So that head coach the following year, she took the head coaching position at Southern Mississippi and was in a boat where they were expanding on their equipment managers there at the time. She was like, hey, if you want to come down here, this is closer to your hometown, and I can essentially get you the same package in terms of tuition and a stipend and things here. And I said, yeah, if you can get my foot in the door with their strength and conditioning program day one, then absolutely. So, and she did. So as soon as I got there, I met with their staff. We organized a way for me to do an internship and some observation hours. And I essentially interned with those guys from my freshman through my senior year in undergrad. And then they offered me a graduate assistant position, which I did a two-year program in exercise science and sports administration while I was there. So from there, I ended up getting a position at a small NAIA school in Jackson, Mississippi, Belhaven College at the time. They're a Division II school now, Belhaven University. But I ran their strength and conditioning department for about close to 3 years, and I believe I was their second strength coach they had ever hired. So the first guy was there for a couple years, and then he moved on, and I was there for 3 years. And that's when I got picked up by the U.S. Olympic Committee. So got hired on as a strength and conditioning coordinator at the OTC in Colorado Springs, which basically means you're the assistant to every other strength and conditioning coach in the USOC nationwide. And then eventually carved myself a role in acrobat and combat sports there at the OTC. And that's where I really got a lot of not just high-level athlete experience, but experience in a lot of the developmental pipelines of USA Wrestling and USA Taekwondo and Judo. So seeing how those NGBs were organizing some of their talent identification and some of their long-term training from kids that they were identifying at 9 and 10 years old and putting them in a pipeline where they could continue to develop up into world levels, you know, into their late teens. So that was great exposure for me. Spent about just under 3 years at the OTC, and then took a position as the assistant director of strength and conditioning for Olympic sports at Michigan in Ann Arbor, and spent about 8.5 years there. Great experience. Anytime you can spend that much time in one place, it really lets you know kind of how you're growing as a practitioner and if you're actually installing things that are causing some sort of long-term influence. So that was a tremendous experience for me there.
Pretty rare, it seems, to have that type of tenure in the collegiate strength and conditioning. It's a very, very nomadic field.
Yeah, it is. It's a struggle, you know. It's tough to not only find a place where you're happy and you can continue to grow professionally, but a place that is willing to invest in you and to allow you to continue to grow in a variety of different ways. And so while we were there, I mean, we grew from a staff of 3 to a staff of 11 paid professionals across 32 sports. We picked up 2 additional sports while we were there, and men's and women's lacrosse. And then we added some facilities along the way as well. So they just opened up a world-class track and field / performance venue there right now. If you ever get a chance to see that, it's unbelievable. 200-meter banked hydraulic track indoors with a 300-meter training track around it, throwing bays that are heated that you can throw from inside to outside in the wintertime, full outdoor track stadium as well. And then right next to it, they built the men's and women's lacrosse outdoor stadium.
I had a heated throwing bay, too. It was called California.
California, yeah. So, you know, for those guys to be able to throw the jab and the hammer and some of those things through the winter month, I mean, that's massive. That's huge. Yep. They also have the capacity to be able to host some major events, some national and international events. So they're working on negotiations with professional track and field events and that being a hosting venue for some of that, as well as now finally being able to host, like, a Big Ten championships, which hasn't been done at Michigan, I don't think, ever. If it has, it was a long time ago before they had some of the regulations around, you know, stadium capacity and things like that. But phenomenal venue. They have an indoor rowing tank there now. Their crew teams can train indoors during the wintertime because the river's frozen, so you can't get a boat out on that stuff. But, unbelievable facility. The weight room in there, I can't remember how many thousands of square feet. It's massive. There's 42 platforms and workstations in there. There's another like 16,000 square feet upstairs worth of turf area and cardio space. In an athletics department that services close to 900 student athletes, massive facilities like that are beneficial. Mm-hmm. So compared to, you look at, you know, we have a pretty high-tech venue here. We don't necessarily need the capacity. We're not servicing quite as many athletes, nor are we doing it in a team setting where you have 50 to 60 in there at a time. So, but that was a tremendous experience, a lot of professional growth for me, and getting to interact with just a ton of great professionals while I was there. And then this opportunity here, so the UFC essentially had a third-party group that was helping them kind of vet and get through, you know, talent identification for some of these different department heads. And some of my work in dealing with some of our national coaches in combat sports through the USOC, that word had kind of trickled around, and a guy got a hold of my name. So he reached out, and we had some initial conversations, which later on turned into some Skype interviewing with the vice presidential crew here. And then a few months later, we were Vegas bound. So been here since about May of 2017.
From cutting grass on the softball field to the UFC, that's a pretty remarkable journey there. So in your role as director of the UFC Performance Institute, it's a very august sounding title, but what does that mean? You know, what are you slated or, you know, commissioned to do? What is your goal?
So I'll clarify a little bit. I'm the director of strength and conditioning for the UFC Performance Institute. We actually have some smarter people that direct the entire facility and the visions behind it. But probably the most attractive thing and what starts where our initiatives are in terms of what we're trying to influence here is it's a true high performance setup. So we have a vice president of high performance along with a vice president of operations and a vice president of athlete development. And those three coordinate different areas of how we manage and work and how we interact with athletes and different fight teams and different gyms. So for me, I'd been in and out of places where we tried our best to put together a true high performance recipe, but there's always little things that don't just quite work out. The USOC, we tried and tried again, but it's still very difficult to get entities from athletic medicine and nutrition and psychology to interact with strength and conditioning and the NGB coaching staffs. They've come pretty close a few times, but just there's always little hiccups, and whether it's political or whether it's financial, it is tough in a nonprofit organization to overcome some of those obstacles. I think we did a pretty good job when we were there, but Michigan, another place, tremendous resources, big revenue making university, still some struggles in terms of really being able to break down some barriers. And not all those are in-house. Some of those are, you know, NCAA rules and guidelines. It's really difficult to have a true high performance scenario when they're limiting you on the number of hours you can train and prepare and recover.
Yeah. And to clarify what Bo means by a high performance scenario, this is the synergistic, you know, efforts of many different fields towards the preparation of the athlete. So, and I think it's so critical in the case of MMA and the UFC, because you're managing so many different modalities that they have to train. And in the work that I got to do with some MMA fighters and everything, when they have a boxing coach, a wrestling coach, a jiu-jitsu coach, you know, a Muay Thai coach, a strength and conditioning coach, and if those people aren't all on the same page, and that is the role that the high performance director would play, is sort of governing over all of the different specialty coaches and making sure that everyone doesn't decide, hey, this is the week that we're all going high volume. You know, this is the week where we're all going to smash you with very similar stimulus, because, you know, the body can only take so much. And if one is going to step it up a little bit, something else has got to back off a little bit. And it's critical to maximizing performance for sure. So that is, you know, just to clarify what he means when he's talking about high performance.
Right. So as a practitioner who's bounced around and strived to try to find this scenario, here you are, a company that is kind of creating this. So there's a little hesitancy there as well. They'd never done it before, so I didn't know if they would be good at it. So there was a lot of vetting back and forth with trying to figure out if the recipe they were putting together was going to be an effective one. So quickly, once I started discovering some of the caliber of the personnel that they were bringing in some of these various areas, because the world of performance is still a small world. It's very easy to dig around and figure out who's got what pedigree and what kind of experience they have that they're bringing with them. So, you know, I had actually a pretty influential track coach in my career who said, like, people with 20 years of experience, and then there are people that have a 20-year experience. That's a very different thing. So I think that tells a lot about the quality of the experience that you have as you're getting ready for something. So being here directing strength and conditioning as a team, one of the biggest things in front of us is we need to figure out methods to employ to extend fighters' careers and to make sure that they're showing up for fight cards on weight and healthy, ready to go. So a lot of where this got formulated was essentially identifying, a financial leak. You know, where are we missing the boat in terms of our performance as a company, and recognizing some metrics around fighters, number of fighters missing weight on some really big fight cards, which then puts a dent in pay-per-view revenue and gate revenue and things like that. So once they started identifying things around, you know, some dumb injuries during training camp that were probably avoidable and people miss some weight because they're not managing things correctly. They're like, well, what are we doing proactively as a company to provide them with resources so they can better execute these things? And the answer was nothing. So, you know, what do we need to do? And that's where this kind of, this idea spawned from. So now fast forward a little bit, you know, it's a little bit of a double-edged sword because, oh, you got a performance institute, you got a multi-million dollar facility, some high-level personnel. Athletes can just show up last minute, you'll push a button and fix them, and then they can just make weight and they're healthy and no problem. So that is not the case at all. So we are very investigative in our approach in terms of getting the lay of the land. There are some really good practitioners out there that are fighting these battles and doing these things already. They're just doing it at a smaller capacity. They may have access to two or three UFC fighters, mm-hmm. in some cases maybe as many as 10. That's still a small chunk compared to the 540, you know, person roster. And then they're limited. They may only have a couple of different weight classes that they're exposed to. So there's so many variables. And what we're trying to do is play a role of, yes, we want to be influential. We want to impact the quality of career for these fighters. We also want to act as a resource of information for practitioners that are out there that are working with these fighters as well. So in order to do that, first thing we had to be able to do is gather information. So a ton of diagnostics and information gathering around fight metrics and training metrics in the first 7.5 months that we've been open, and with aspirations of ultimately being influential over the training cultures and some of the weight cutting cultures that have caused some problems in MMA.
Well, awesome. Let's go ahead and go take a walk through this fantastic facility, and we can see where a lot of the work Bo was talking about actually happens.
So what we're seeing right now, the majority of our usage, or at least the introduction of, here's the PI, here's how you can tap into the resources of the PI, here's what you have access to as a UFC employee, is when they come in for events. So we host events, you know, 5 or 6 times a year here in town. So they'll come in, either their manager is promoting another fighter that's on the card there, or they're actually on the card. So they'll come out early, they'll bring their entire fight camp with them, their coaches, their training partners, and they'll essentially spend the last few weeks of their fight camp here in preparations for that event. So that's kind of how we've been getting those that are way overseas in here. But that's kind of part of our initiative over the next like year and a half. Our goals leading into the first year was, in the first 6 months, we wanted to get about 40% of our roster in here, and we got way over that. We've had about 260 of them through here so far. And so now I would imagine, as we set goals for 2018, we want to be right around that 100% mark by the end of the summer. Yeah. So, because it's something so new. They've never had a resource like this. They've never had access to anything. Yeah. Everything they've had, you got to pay for it out of your purse. So, it's going to be a lot of, we got to kind of put it in front of them as much as we can. Now, a lot of the success we've had is, once we put it in front of them, they're all about it, you know, because we're not, which is odd for them to understand at first, but we're not for any particular fighter. We work for the UFC, right? So we're there to provide services for all of them. And that's tough to understand until you get here and get in front of it and you meet with, you know, some of the different professionals. And the other thing is, we're here as a resource and a liaison for their professionals. We have some fighters that have a ton of resources. They have their own strength coaches. They have their own PTs, a nutritionist, whatever, psychologists. Some of them travel around with life coaches or whatever. And we're essentially there to be a liaison, a service provider for them as well. So we can typically get our hands on data and metrics that they can't in their, you know, mom and pop facility that they've got in their local area. So, you know, it's our job to give the fighter whatever they need to be more successful. So if that means helping out their fight team as well, that comes along with it.
Awesome. So that's really cool.
So this is the main wrestling area. You can feel it's, keep it a little warmer up here. Yeah. So main bag area, a lot of modular bags, different styles of bags. How's it going? This is a full competition size octagon, so it's 30 by 30. It's the same one that they fight in. And then right now we're rocking a pro size boxing ring. So we had an Olympic boxing ring in, which most of the guys that train in boxing clubs, they usually come up in an Olympic ring. We switched to a pro ring. Connor did his last 6 weeks of his preparation going into the Mayweather fight here, and so it was important that he had a couple of extra square footage in there to be able to get ready for the size of the ring. So, and then a lot of auxiliary open space for shadow boxing and the, you know, doing different types of circuits and training and things in between rounds and stuff like that. So,
Yep.
Just to give them some auxiliary space, and sometimes it's carryover from, you know, if the weight room's full or whatever, then we got some overflow space to do some things in here as well. Just behind the curtain on the other side, there's a big press conference room. So that first room we started in is the media holding space, and then the big press conference room is in there. So typically, when you see like big fight announcements and, you know, Dana sitting at a table and that kind of, that's usually in that space there. So we also host educational symposiums out of there. So we hosted the NSCA Combat Clinic out of there as well. It's where we held all of our lectures. And then we also do fighter education in there around finance and marketing and social media conduct and all that kind of stuff. Do it in there as well.
The UFC social media conduct soul. Yeah, a little looser policy than like the NFL.
Yeah, you can you can try to lead them to water, but they still, you know, a lot of them, in order for them to market themselves and become you know, entertaining, they gotta get a little crazy sometimes.
It'd be tough to tell some guy like, oh, don't do it like Conor McGregor. No,
that's not how you do it. So we got a few translation booths in there as well. Only I want to say like 30-something% of our fighters speak English. I mean, it's a small percentage. Wow. So. If you look at all the different dialects in Europe and the Ukraine, Eastern Europe, and then all the mixtures of dialects that are in South America and Asia, I mean, there's a ton. So that's one thing the UFC has done really well. We don't have any trouble communicating with anyone because there's always an interpreter on hand that we can reach out to helps with that.
Portuguese or?
I actually don't even have, man, I get spoiled because we have software that automatically translates for us. And then if we got a question, we have a translator that's either dealing with their promoter or their manager. So it's usually hands off.
I know, so I trained a bunch of jiu-jitsu guys before I started training jiu-jitsu. So I can tell you, Bora Bish, that's a good one. That's like, you know, just like, come on, let's go. Empuje Caralho, that's push, motherfucker. So if you need to throw those in.
Yeah.
Bundo Grande, that's a big ass. That's important to when you're talking to those guys.
So we had when I did some jiu-jitsu in college, we had a guy that his nickname was Zipponi Ching, which means ass weevil. And so he's basically the guy that he's kind of like crawling up your ass the whole time. You could never get him off you, but that's about the only word I know. Yeah. So again, the theme, second floor, all MMA specific. The bottom floor is all locker rooms and human performance. Got a little Hall of Fame on the wall. The Hall of Fame is fairly new to the UFC. They just started doing it a few years ago. So I'm sure it'll grow quite a bit. There's still some notable names that aren't up there yet. It's when you hear the stories too from the Fertittas and from Dana, and it was crazy. I mean, I think they had vision. I don't know if they had a vision that it would get quite this big, but
some big eyes.
Yeah. So the main lobby where you guys first came in is right out there. So the logistics of how they set this thing up. They got a lot of inspiration from, for one, when they built this thing, they spent about 2.5 years researching high-performance training centers around the world. So they visited over 60 of them. Probably one of the most influential is the Manchester City Football Club in Manchester, England. Now, they have a facility that services about 1,600 players from ages like 12 to, you know, they're professionals that are in their 40s. So massive campus, like, I forget what they said, but, you know, somewhere in a ballpark of hundreds of acres. Multiple outdoor and indoor fields, like huge. So dummy that down to about a 540 person roster that we have. And we've essentially took a lot of their logistical layout and the convenience for athletes and put it into this 15 acre chunk of land and about a 30,000 square foot training facility. So men's and women's locker rooms are kind of the focal point. So it's quick access to get just about anywhere they need from the locker room space. So when they come in, they can custom fill their whatever combination they want in there, and then showers. You can imagine how important it is to have a check weight scale around all the time. So, and then you know, anything they need as far as just keeping tidy in between sessions. So another thing you'll notice, there's a couple of USADA checkpoint kiosks that are around. so that they can always kind of touch base and tell them where they're at. We have a cryotherapy chamber, and the Novathor is a low-level infrared laser light therapy pod. Basically what that means is kind of very similar to the vasodilation that gets caused by like a hot tub without some of the heat exhaustion effects that come along with the hot tub. So
the first time I heard about this kind of setup was from some European British track guys. They referred to it as an infrared tent.
Okay.
Like a sauna type of room, but yep. Infrared heating.
Yep.
And that must have been 5 years ago now, but they swore by those.
Yeah. The feedback we get from some of the fighters, while sometimes they'll come out of steam or they'll come out of the hot tub a little bit exhausted, they'll come out of this like energized. They feel like they're ready to go. So, when it comes to recovery methods, if you're going to get into that sympathetic nervous system, you got to get past a lot of the mental hesitation around things. So like cold tubbing is great, but if you're terrified of getting in the cold tub, it doesn't do so good. So that's why we wanted to have options like this so they have some alternatives. And then we're still working to do a little bit more study around what's most beneficial based on the type of MMA training they just got done doing so that the recovery is meeting the demand of the exhaustion. So that's an area that is still a little bit in its infancy. We haven't perfected yet, but that's something that's on our list to try to maximize. Because up to this point, there's been no like hard effort at trying to maximize recovery methods for fighters. So hot and cold plunge, keep the cold in the low 50s. We keep the hot little over 100 degrees. We have a underwater treadmill system, which we use it for two ways. One is rehabilitation settings. We can start from a low level walk with the water at basically neck height to keep them buoyant. And then as we introduce walking eventually into running, we have a 4-camera monitoring system that's mounted down in there so you can take a look at their gait and all that kind of stuff. Our PTs work pretty hand in hand with that. I like to use it quite a bit with our big guys, the heavyweights, to keep them when we still need to burn calories, but I don't really want to pound them doing a lot of, So it's a good alternative in that aspect. We also have an Alter G on site to do some anti-gravity running as well. But anything we can take the load off the big guys, it definitely helps. So you can imagine how important the steam and the dry sauna are, especially around when it's fight time in Vegas. This thing is full. I mean, there's bodies laying around everywhere, towels all over the place. People just mummified in the corners, wrapped up in wet towels. So. Compared to weightlifting, I mean, they take boiling to a whole nother level.
Yeah.
So it's.
I know that they've introduced a lot more regulation about the weight cut.
Yep.
Do you ever foresee the UFC maybe going to a 4-hour or a 2-hour weigh-in or anything like that?
At least not in the near future.
Yeah.
That's one where I think they'll go the route of tightening up the regulations around check-in, which we already have. There's a limit, and I don't want to misquote it, but somewhere around the 10% mark, 7 days out at check-in.
I was going to say 8% is what I thought.
Something around there. I would see those regulations getting tighter before they start to cut down on, the time between weigh-in. That's one of those cultural things that, as an institute, they're expecting us to provide metrics around, trying to figure out what's the best method where we can still have exciting fights, but people are maximizing their potential in the most appropriate weight class that they need to be in. So it's a tricky one because that's that goes way beyond MMA. That's a 150-year-old boxing culture and wrestling culture that you're dealing with as well. So we have a fueling station right outside, which is managed by our director of nutrition. So they can consult here, they can prescribe, pre-fueling, post-fueling, that kind of thing. But then they also will work hand in hand with our cafe to custom build meals, whether it's breakfast or lunch, sometimes dinner, for the special cases that we're really trying to work to either fix metabolically or just improve their daily habits of how they're fueling themselves. So this is our physical therapy suite. The young lady standing in the back is Heather Linden. She's our director of physical therapy. She came over from the Olympic Training Center in Colorado Springs. And she has an assistant that helps her out as well. So I would say in terms of demand of services, she's probably one of the highest in demand. So we are at the point now where we're actually shipping her and her assistant out at different events, depending on where they are, to be able to not only treat, but also just interact with athletes, particularly at pay-per-view events. Mm-hmm. Some of them still are unaware that they have, you know, full-on medical services at their fingertips that are at no cost right here. And so it's funny, she gets out there and interacts with them at an event, and they're like, wow, we have access to, you know, like, we can, and she's like, yeah, no problem, just come out. And so the byproduct of that is she's pretty much our biggest recruiter right now in terms of getting the roster in here. We do have a partnership with HSS, which is a big worldwide orthopedic hospital. So the nice thing is our athletes, regardless of where they're at, where the event's being hosted, we have access to doctors and surgeons pretty much worldwide. It's, you know, it's a combat sport. So the name of the game is to hurt your opponent. So we're, you know, injuries are going to happen. So it's important that we're able to provide some medical coverage, whether they're in a third world country in South America or in Eastern Europe or Asia. So we have an auxiliary turf space. You know, the weather 99% of the time in Vegas is awesome, but when it is 120 degrees outside, or if it's, you know, there's a hailstorm coming in the weird part of what they call winter, it's nice to be able to get inside and move around in here. So a lot of variety of different pieces that we mess around with here. Two impact walls you can slam stuff up against. We also have these that we're able to clip in and out of anytime we're doing any kind of band resisted stuff. We hook Raptor systems up to them as well to be able to do bungee resisted stuff out of there too. So it just allows, you know, mixed martial arts is it's kind of like the decathlon of combat sports. So to be able to offer variety is probably one of the most important things in a facility. So that was kind of the thought process between having a lot of different spaces. They essentially hired a third party company that's all they do is build high performance training centers around the world. The predominance of what they build is in the realm of rugby, soccer, Olympic training venues and things like that. So I would say they damn near hit the nail right on the head. Yeah. There are a few things that we've made some tweaks and adjustments on, but for the most part, they did a phenomenal job in terms of thinking out the space, thinking out little logistical things like sound and light distribution and keep climate control and things like that. So things that are pretty important in terms of being able to host fighters and getting them to enjoy wanting to be here. If you have a training facility and it's averaging 65 degrees inside, fighters aren't going to want to train there. I mean, we have fighters that come over from gyms to do some of their grappling and some of their striking just because at certain times of the year, they don't keep the gym warm enough. So they come over for that. So it was important that they got a lot of those finite details correct so that it would be an environment those guys want to come in. They're definitely not used to seeing, this can appear as a very Rocky Four-ish looking white collar kind of a training facility. They're not used to seeing that. So once they get in and we can show them the details of why it's specific for a fighter and the preparation for a fighter, then they quickly fall in love with it. So that's been important. But they did a great job of ironing out some of those details. The cardio space, a big key for us is variety. So high impact, low impact, whether we're working towards some kind of metabolic or conditioning goal or we're just simply managing weight and the weight cut. It's just important to have a lot of variety. So, and then the main weight training space, there's actually, I think they've just completed, we have a VO2 max assessment going on right now. So the nice thing about this facility is that a lot of our diagnostics are integrated with our daily routine. We don't have to, what we try to avoid, especially since we may have an athlete in for 24 hours who's just here doing contractual agreement stuff. And we're like, hey, let's do some diagnostics while you're here. And so to be able to quickly dive into some of that stuff on the fly is really key for us. So we have bilateral force plates that are mounted into the two of our platforms. Part of our first assessments when we first meet with a fighter face to face is doing a full strength and power profile. So that consists of an assessment of reactive strength. So we do a 40 centimeter drop jump on the bilateral force plate, a counter movement jump, a mid-thigh isometric pull, and then we use an elite form system that's mounted on the rack to measure bar velocity doing a speed squat. So we do a 3-repetition, 3-set, progressively loaded speed squat to start to build a power curve. So that's something that we'll track over time. So we get kind of a baseline and a very sub-maximal load, and then over time we'll increase those loads and start to build more of a comprehensive power curve, essentially seeing how they react to different loads during different times of the training paradigm. So that's what our current strength and power profile consists of. Now, while it sounds complete, for us, it's very rudimentary. It's a basic physiological profile. What we're working on as a group is building things that are much more skill specific to MMA fighters. So taking this raw strength and power profile and then also matching it with a more specific kicking, striking, sprawling, clinching, those types of things, and assessing those things specifically. You know, strength and power, that tells us about the capacity of an instance, mm-hmm. right? A strike or defending a takedown, which happens instantaneously. Which, when it comes to the metabolic breakdown, it's a roller coaster ride when you talk 3 5-minute rounds or in the championship fight, 5 5-minute rounds. So right now, our metabolic profiling is busted down into a three-part assessment. So first, we take baseline blood lactate, which we have a blood analyzer in the lab as well. We get a baseline sample. We do a submaximal step test where essentially they're in two and a half minute stages. So every 2.5 minutes, we're taking a blood sample. The next 2.5 minutes, the speed goes up a little, but it's still all four stages are really submaximal. And we're essentially trying to get them to that 4 millimoles of blood lactate, which is kind of a universal number that's used across all sports, to see how quickly they get there. We have some fighters that get there in 2 stages. We have some fighters that go through all 4 stages and don't hit 4 millimoles. So that tells us a little bit about whether you call it talent or whether you call it their development as an athlete, tells us a little bit how they accumulate lactic acid. Then we do a traditional step test, VO2 max. Every minute the intensity is going up. Not all of them are great runners, so we can perform the test on a bike or on the treadmill. On the treadmill, once the gait starts to break down, we'll just increase the incline versus continuing to increase the speed. But yeah, so once their technique starts to break down, we just increase the intensity by picking up the incline. So once we hit a maximum, our metabolic cart, we can essentially through gas analysis, we can figure out when they're hitting VT1, which ventilative threshold 1, which is essentially when their body starts to really accumulate a fair amount of lactic acid, and then VT2, which is when their body essentially makes the shift, they can no longer buffer the lactic acid, and they pretty much become purely aerobic at that point, purely O2 driven. So for us, it's not necessarily, we're not looking for fighters to have just this giant VO2 max. I mean, if you look at elite marathoners, they're like in the low 80s, whereas about the highest we've assessed so far from some of our fittest fighters, around 61, 62. It's more so where those percentages lie, that VT1 and where the VT2 occur in relevance to that maximum. And then also what the distance is between them. So if VT1 is at 86%, which is a really good number, but VT2 is at 88%, that just means that, they have a long threshold, but once they hit it, they basically fall off the cliff. Whereas these fighters need to be able to not only tolerate lactic acid, but sustain a very high intensity of work for prolonged periods of time. Because as I don't know any fighters that are trying to pace the fight. Most of them are trying to push the tempo as much as they can. So once we have that maximum, we have those two thresholds, then probably the worst part of the test, they still have the mask on. They basically got to they have to hang their hand off the side, and we stab them 5 more times on the minute, every minute, to get a look at blood lactate recovery. So we start to see how quickly their body can flush it out, just as much as we're taking a look to see how quick they accumulate it in the beginning. So that metabolic profile, along with the strength and power profile, really gives us kind of an understanding of just what type of athlete we're dealing with, because it's such a melting pot that comes in here. And really, a lot of it it's determined by genetics, but some of it's determined on how they cut their teeth. MMA fighters come from all walks of life, whether they're strikers, or they're originally a wrestler or a grappler. And now we're getting them from American football, we're getting them from overseas soccer and rugby. They're coming out of all different kinds of walks of life. Where traditionally a lot of people got into fighting in their late teens, now we're seeing fighters that are jumping into the sport in their mid-30s and late 20s. So it's kind of like Christmas. We don't really know what we're going to unwrap until we get all the assessment
and
done.
To that side of the background, I mean, at my jiu-jitsu school, I see they have 100 members who are under 10 years old.
Yeah.
You're going to get kids who... It would be very rare, I'd imagine, at this point, for anyone who's in the UFC to have said, when I was a kid, I grew up wanting to be in the UFC.
Yeah.
But now there's going to be tens of thousands of kids aspiring to that as their ultimate goal. rather than the NFL or the NBA or MLB or whatever it is, and you're going to have these combat MMA lifers.
Yeah.
Early specialization in sure. MMA, maybe.
And what we're seeing is those kids that are cutting their teeth at that young age, wrestling or grappling, they typically tolerate lactic acid better. And vice versa, the ones that are cutting their teeth in Thailand, Muay Thai kickboxing or traditional boxing, they're much more of an O2 animal. So typically they have the higher VO2 maxes, the greater O2 capacity. But as soon as you start to wrap them up and clinch them, you know, yeah. up against the cage is when they fatigue. So what we're trying to do as an institute is first assess and identify where they are on that spectrum so that we can contribute appropriate metabolic training needs or conditioning needs to meet wherever they're lacking. That's the kind of thing. So our kind of catchphrase right now with a lot of the fighters and fight teams we're meeting with is, if you're not assessing, you're guessing. And so the first thing we kind of start everything with is a full-on assessment.
That's very cool.
Yeah.
That's really cool. So, this place is super impressive.
Yeah. So there's quite a few members of our team in there right now conducting this test. So the little bald gentleman in the gray t-shirt there is Dr. Duncan French. He's our vice president of high performance. Previously the director of sports science at Notre Dame, and then prior to that, working for the English Institute of Sport. And then right next to him is Clint Wattenberg. He's our director of nutrition. Clint was a former All-American wrestler at Cornell, was a national teamer. Clint, actually, we just crossed paths. He was on a couple of national teams when I worked for USA Men's Freestyle. But probably, I would say, in terms of experience, both as a wrestler, he also has a couple of MMA fights under his belt as well.
Who we got on the treadmill there?
This is Sajara Eubanks. She's one of our 125-pounders, so she's here for 2 weeks doing some training, doing some assessment. And she's also doing some MMA training down the street at one of the local MMA clubs. So this is kind of where it starts for us. So here we have one of our professional athletes who's new to the roster, wants to maximize all the resources that the UFC has to offer. So we bring her in. We start her visit out with a full-on diagnostics. We did a lot of her strength and power profiling just the other day. And then in between, Forrest and other members of our staff are taking her around trying to vet to see which MMA gym she wants to train at while she's here. We get her squared away with our nutrition team, get her meals set up at the cafe, and then we're going to try to educate her on once we're done with the diagnostics, we'll sit down and come up with a plan of action. Okay, here's what we suggest you do in terms of, if you're going to spend time doing S&C, here's where it needs to be. If you're going to spend time refining your diet, here's where it needs to be. With her, she has a few professionals that she works with as well, so we'll be liaisoning through those individuals based on her. That's all based on her initiative. So, and then we'll kind of go from there. So while she's here, we're going to try to give her as many tools for her toolbox as we can before she heads back home to New Jersey in the next few days.
Is there anyone that trains here full time?
We have just under 30 fighters that train here full time right now.
And they have they basically maximize use of facility with coaches.
In the beginning, there was some hesitancy, right? It was like, oh, well, the UFC is trying to keep tabs on us. They just want to keep us close so that they can use some of this information against us when we're negotiating contracts and things like that. So there were some skeptical ones, rightfully so, right? Some would argue that the UFC didn't do a great job of taking care of some of their fighters in previous years. But then once they get in and they see the environment and they see what they have access to, they also see the level of confidentiality around the services that we provide. I mean, there's information that execs need to know, and then there's some that they don't need to know in terms of the daily training regimen and things like that. Ultimately, they figure out that we're employees for them. So we're here to service whatever they think they need. And then they grow pretty high affinity for it. So. There aren't very many local fighters on the UFC. There may not be any right now that are not utilizing this facility. Very few, if there are. It's one of those that kind of spreads like wildfire.
Yeah.
And now, you know, our fighters, they can bring, you know, three or four training partners in with them when they come. So we do have some fighters from other fight leagues that are coming in. Now, they're not getting the individual programming attention that our contracted fighters are getting, but they still get access to the facility. They still get access to all the training grounds. They get access to some of the recovery tools and things like that. So it even benefits their training partners to be involved as well.
Right. That's really cool.
Yeah, and you know, that's one of their expenses, right? I mean, a lot of these guys, you pay training partners to help you out with your camp. Well, when you can offer this as part of your camp, that kind of helps soften things up as well.
Definitely.
Outside, we have four bay doors that we can quickly open up to access getting outside. Like I said, I mean, 90 to 95% of the time, the weather's great here. Blue skies, sunny. We have a 2-lane 50-meter track that runs alongside that exterior wall out here. And then the rest of the spaces that are out here are creative meeting spaces for all the different departments here at our headquarters to utilize. So the headquarters is kind of busted up departmentally to some extent. So just through those doors and that wing over there is our production team. So when you see the really cool stuff on social media and pay-per-view and on Fox, a lot of that content will come from those guys over there. Those guys are geniuses when it comes to getting people on camera. Then if you look at the bottom floor across the way, that's our cafe, which we can walk through in just a little bit. The athletes get served breakfast, and it's full service breakfast and lunch. And then there's grab and go options for later in the day. And then also our nutrition team will work to strategize sometimes dinner meals and things like that, depending on the case. Up top are most of the executive offices. Dana White and his matchmakers and a lot of the legal team are up top. And then over in the other wing there are some other departments around finance and marketing, as well as some of the crew that has joined from IMG. So IMG purchased the company, which they're actually now known as the Endeavor Group is their new name, but purchased the UFC about 2 years ago. And so a lot of their offices are in there as well. Most of those guys have several offices all across the country, but yeah, they got to have a place to lay their head when they come over. So, yeah. So that's pretty much the meat and potatoes of the Institute.
It seems like a pretty sweet place to come to work every day.
It's like Disneyland. I mean, if you're in our field, I mean, it is very cool. So we have a lot of work to do. We got a lot of unique challenges, but you get good driven personnel that've got some good experience, and you got a company that's not shy about giving you whatever tool you need. Then there's some cool aspirations in there.
All right, we are back at the UFC Performance Institute with Director of Strength and Conditioning, Bo Sandoval. We just saw what is one of the most impressive facilities I think you could ever hope to see for if you're into lifting weights and human performance. So as we look at the training of UFC fighters, it's going to be such a broad and such a diverse thing with so many different fighters with different backgrounds and everything. But we know, Max and I know you as a weightlifting coach, as kind of Colin Burns' original weightlifting coach. And then you were running Ann Arbor Barbell?
Michigan Barbell.
Michigan Barbell up there. And
your wife was a pretty good weightlifter too, right?
Oh, yeah.
She was pretty decent.
She was okay.
My wife, I had this affinity to weightlifting earlier in my career. For one, I didn't necessarily know why, but I knew that it was an effective training tool pretty early on. At least my mentors told me so anyway. And then being exposed at the Olympic Training Center to not only the resident coaching staff there, but a multitude of coaches coming through on training camps, both nationally and internationally. And then getting exposed to all weight classes, male and female, and then seeing developmental youth, coming in on camps at 8 and 9 and 10 years old, up through masters lifters coming through there. So that definitely solidified kind of my infatuation with the sport whenever I was there. My wife was on 4 or 5 world teams. She made her first Olympic trials after about 5 months of lifting. So she was another John Coffey talent that came out of Georgia. But and she's always kept me honest in the weightlifting world. I mean, her lifts have been far more impressive than mine ever were. But as I was going through trying to be a successful young strength and conditioning professional, I found myself having some time to be able to spend on learning how to cultivate a training program and a structure for weightlifters. So I thought, well, I'll try this out. I got enough educated people around me, they can let me know when I'm making mistakes or managing things wrong. So that was a really fruitful time in my career because, for one, weightlifting is just super one-on-one. I mean, it is one of the training cultures where you can just get ultra-specific with an individual. Similar to, a hammer coach coaching a hammer thrower. You can just get really intimate in terms of tweaking fine details in the overall training scheme. So I love that aspect about it. Fast forward to now, in terms of the role and the place that some of these movements and training systems have in MMA. MMA is like the decathlon of combat sports. So just the raw physiology of looking at the different fighters from different weight classes, strength and power is an attribute, relative strength and power is an attribute that is definitely can dictate or or help deem what the outcome of a fight's going to be. If you have two fighters that both essentially weigh in the same and the talent level and the experience level is fairly close, you can have an edge in terms of athleticism, whether it be speed or just the raw strength and power component. So with MMA, unfortunately, there's not a huge pedigree of barbell training in terms of their early on development. So we're getting fighters that come to us now that are several years into their career that have never touched a barbell, let alone a weightlifting movement. So there's a spectrum, obviously. We have some that are familiar with powerlifting techniques. Some are familiar with weightlifting and other barbell techniques. Some are not. Some are super experienced in kettlebells and a variety of different things. So through our assessment process, we'll kind of figure out which tools we'll be able to employ most readily. So it depends on the scenario. If we're in someone that just comes to us and they're 6 weeks out from a fight and we're looking to supplement their training, may not be the best time to start teaching technique along the lines of snatching and jerking and all those kinds of things.
You were saying earlier that you had it's a worldwide group of people. Do you know if there's any like one demographic or geographical region where people are coming from that has a bigger exposure to barbell training and that kind of stuff?
Sure. I mean, the Scandinavians, we have some fighters, you know, different areas of Scandinavia, some of the Asian cultures. We just had a fighter in, I believe, from Norway, who was here for the last few weeks, and great weightlifter. Someone taught him well. I mean, he can clean. A lot of them try to. I think it's from the rigors of boxing. Boxing just beats your shoulders up, especially hitting bags all the time. A lot of them tend to shy away from snatching.
Yeah.
They feel a little bit more comfortable push pressing and things like that are a little bit narrower in the grip. We had a young lady that spent a number of months with us that was from Venezuela, who had done a little bit of dabbling, and first day she was like, I'm really interested in kind of perfecting my technique in the snatch and the clean and jerk. No problem. We're off camp. She's coming off of a rigorous, like, 6-month rehab program from an ACL repair. Like, we can build this into your programming easy. She's super developmental at the time. And so that's something that we took pretty far, to the point where, you know, she's snatching power snatching, about 70-75% of her body mass, which for an MMA fighter is significant, and then cleating 130% of her body mass. So, there are scenarios where they are an employable tactic where we can make a difference in terms of rate of force development and improving some of their speed attributes. But that's all it is. I mean, I think it's most important with this sport is to have a thick toolbox. And then based on the opportunity, what the training scenario is, and what the kind of initiatives are by the fighter, the fight team, and, you know, again, is it a rehab scenario? Are we out of camp? Are we in camp? Then reaching in your toolbox, oh, I have something for that. And you pull it out, and we use it.
Yeah, and development of the athlete has got to be one of the biggest things. I'm sure when you had a freshman who was redshirting at Michigan is a much different story than someone who's been fighting in the UFC for 5 years. Which is a much different story than a 14-year-old high school wrestler, where it's like, we got plenty of time to teach this kid how to snatch or clean and jerk.
Right.
Where, you know, the Conor McGregors of the world, it's like, well, they seem to be doing pretty well with what they've got going. Yeah,
sure.
And it's not going to, you know, that's not going to be the make or break difference of how much can he snatch.
Yep.
So I think it becomes such a debated topic. And what I really like to see with someone like you who has, you know, weightlifting pedigree, is coaches so easily, they want to do with their athletes what they do themselves. Mm-hmm. If I do powerlifting, so I want to train athletes like powerlifters, or I do weightlifting, I want to train athletes like weightlifters. And it's such a mistake because they're not, you know, there's no bars in that octagon. I very much appreciate that and I'm refreshed by that to see.
Yeah, well, I mean, one thing there are a lot of things we're trying to uncover. One thing that I can pretty much guarantee is I can't put people to sleep quite as easy as Connor can. So, one thing you have to ultimately do when they first walk in the door, you got to respect the fact that they are elite. If they're at this level and they're in our league, they're very good. They've been identified by someone as being an elite talent in their weight class. And so we need to be influential over physical attributes that we can be influential on that are not going to deter this skill set and this talent that they've already got going their way. That's what they get paid for. And so it's one of those sports, kind of like weightlifting. You spend months and months and weeks training and perfecting your skills and working on little attributes for, you know, just a small time of action, even less than, you know, weightlifting. You get six attempts and that's it.
Yeah.
These guys, most of their fights, they get 15 minutes, and it doesn't matter what you did for, you know, 60 hours a week the previous, you know, 10 weeks. So it's important that we economize their time. It's important that everything we do is in a positive, influential way over their game. And so that's where you really got to have a 30,000-foot view of where we're at in the timeline, what the goals and initiative are of the fighter. You got to understand that they're driving the vehicle, and we're essentially, well, we want to be up in the front seat. We want to prioritize performance, and we want to prioritize health and wellness and the diet and really trying to extend the longevity of their career. You still have to respect the fact that they're really, really good at what they do, and they've gotten there by doing some of these things that they're doing. So we don't want to totally scrap everything. We just want to be in a very periodized fashion influential over time.
And the sport of MMA is very young, relatively, and as we're talking about things that the fighters may have done before they arrive here and not wanting to scrap everything, anyone who's kind of followed along and seen these, you know, wild ass kind of circuits and stuff that people do, what is one thing from the world of MMA training that that you in this role are hoping to help scrap?
So probably the best and the worst thing about most of these fighters is they're fearless. Most of, I mean, they are who they are for a reason. Now the bad side of that is they'll do just about anything. If I say I'm a reliable source of information around training, do this, they'll typically say, how many times? You know, how many times do you want me to run through that wall? So the nice thing, it is one of the spongiest cultures that there is. If you've got a bit of education to spit, they're there to soak it up. It's incredible just how bought in they are to the process. The downside of that is sometimes it can be gullible. You know, any Joe Schmo that opens up a gym can say, hey, I'm going to show you how to be the most fit fighter. Yeah. We're going to do things that are harder than, you know, Navy SEAL training. Well, they're not going into combat and they're not dodging bullets. There's no risk of drowning or anything like that. We don't need to suffocate them. Although strangulation is one way that you win fights. But, you know, ultimately, you've got to be able to, in terms of them being spongy, in terms of them being able to really get into that mindset where, yeah, man, I'm listening to everything you're saying. You got to give them the why. It is one of the most why cultures that there are, even more so than college kids, which can be pretty bad in terms of why. Coach, why? Tell me why. Why is this? Why is that? They're even worse, but in a good way. I mean, I love that. The fact that if I spend some time doing some education, then they'll eat out of your hand the rest of the time. But you do need to be able to back that information up, and ultimately you're liable if you don't. I mean, that person is in outside of my arena, in most of the arenas that fighters are recruiting, strength coaches and PTs and things like that, they're paying for it. And a lot of times they're paying a lot of money for it, several hundred dollars a week for a fight camp, which that comes out of nowhere but their purse, which, you know, the biggest cut first gets Uncle Sam gets the biggest cut. Mm-hmm. And then they're paying for cornermen, they're paying for cutmen, they're paying for, or not cutmen, sorry, cornermen and coaches, they're paying for hotels, sometimes one or two flights for those coaches to fly wherever they're fighting. So if you're fighting in Poland, that's not always cheap, especially if it's short notice fight. Yeah. You just found out about it 3 weeks ago. Now have fun booking that flight. And then some of these strength coaches that are on the private level, I mean, somewhere upwards of $500 and $600 every 2 weeks, and then some of them are even going at it by a percentage of purse. So yeah, I'll take you through this camp, and then you owe me 8% of your purse. Win or lose, they still get the 8%. So there's a liability there. There should be a level of ethical conduct there, where, you know, you're trying to pitch thoughts and pitch training ideas that are ultimately influential, but that are safe, that are peer-reviewed, that have been time-tested and that actually will do the thing that you're saying that they do. And oftentimes these fighters are in such a rush and there's such a demand for them to be ready, they don't have the time or the resources to vet out you know, what they're using. They don't have the time to really investigate and see, you know, is this reliable? Is this something that, I should pay this much money for?
Are there resources here that, can help people like that? Like they maybe, you know, you have some fighter who finds a coach or a strength coach and they're like, hey, you know, Bo, can you tell me what your thoughts are on this?
Yeah, so that's one way. We kind of look at the programming, we look at the things they're doing, and we give our feedback. But the other thing is just identifying who those – there are some great professionals out there, and so we're trying to identify who they are so that, oh, yeah, I fight in, you know, in Miami. Oh, okay, American Top Team, they've got a strength coach that works down there. He's a good resource. Let's put you in contact with them. Oh, I train out in Colorado. Okay, there's Landau Performance out there. You know, Lauren's got some experience working with a number of fighters. Great. So we're working on doing that worldwide. So, you know, there are fighters that are looking for resources in Asia and South America and Canada and, you know – so that's part of our job as well. And the way we kind of get exposure to those people are through other fighters, but then also with people like Forrest Griffin on staff. Forrest kind of, he knows everyone. He's like the mayor of MMA. So
the front desk.
Right. So, you know, with him, he's got such a good rapport across the sport. It's easy for him to, if he doesn't already have a contact at a specific gym, it's really quick for him to make a contact. Mm-hmm. And so that's a great resource for us to be able to meet other, not only MMA coaches, but SNC coaches and other PTs and nutritionists and things. So, like I said, there are some professionals out there doing it really well. We're trying to make sure that athletes are getting funneled to those and trying to steer away from some of the, you know, the YouTube sensations and things like that. So, now in terms of like crazy stuff we've seen, usually it's an easy conversation. Like, hey man, how'd you feel when you were doing that? And they're like, oh, it was terrible. Like I absolutely felt atrocious when I got done. I had to go through several weeks of PT to repair my shoulder when I got done doing that thing or my hip or whatever. I'm like, all right, do you want to do that again? No. Okay, good. Let me give you some alternatives. That's usually how the conversation goes. It's usually, we don't want to do a lot of bashing. We don't want to discredit any of the work that they've done. Instead, let's just show you some greener grass.
Pivot.
So that's a process. That's a cultural thing that we're going to have to go through. And it's one of those things where, again, you mentioned young sport. We are. We're 25 years. UFC just had its 25th anniversary. And then prior to that, Vale Tudo was, you know, maybe another 10, 15 years before that. So it is very new, especially as organized as it is amongst the fight commissions now. It's extremely new. We figure we're a little ahead of the curve. We're 25 years old. We're already kind of figuring this sports science thing out. It took football like 60 years. So yeah. We figure we're doing all right.
Strongest guy in the UFC. we got meatheads listening to this. Powerlifters, weightlifters. They want to know who can put a bunch of metal on the bar.
Sure. So I can't throw out any names. It's confidentiality is like one of our best things. But we do have guys that are on an isometric pull that are pulling over four times their body mass. So we have some people that are relatively strong. Probably some of the most impressive numbers have come out of the 205-pound weight class and arguably, along with that, the 145-pound class. So some really strong dudes in those classes. On the women's side, the 135 and 145-pounders, we got some females that, again, that are pulling pretty close to that four times their body mass mark. So some pretty – for people that don't specialize in strength, they're coming out of the womb with some good tools. It's funny you ask that because every single fighter, when they come in to do diagnostics, first question they ask, what are the rest of the 155ers doing? Well, I kind of tell them where they fall in the spectrum, but I can't necessarily tell them who's at the top of that spectrum, who's at the bottom.
Well, the guy you're fighting in 3 weeks.
Exactly. they're not very shy about it. If a heavyweight comes in, first question they ask is, I want to know how heavy, you know, what's Francis Ngannou pulling? I'm like, I can't tell you that. Or, you know, what did Cain Velasquez, what's he doing? It's like, no, I'll tell you your numbers and I'll tell you kind of where you're at percentage-wise in that spectrum, but that's about it. So one of the unique aspects of this job that I don't think any other strength and conditioning job ever prepared me for is the level of confidentiality. If you really take a good look, we're essentially like the ultimate health and wellness program, like corporate wellness program. We're working for all the employees, right? And they're competing against each other. So we do have scenarios where we got two guys fighting each other, you know, in an upcoming event that are here training full time. So those are things that we have to very strategically plan out. Can't obviously have those two guys schedule octagon time at the same time. That'd be a problem. And most of the time, it's pretty easily manageable. And even when it comes down to discussing metrics and where they fall on the spectrum of athleticism, usually they're pretty professional about it. But, you know, those are can be tricky conversations. You don't usually have to have those conversations with a group of throwers at, yeah. at Michigan. Yeah, yeah. You know,
it's all good for you, though, because if you're working with both fighters, you can't lose.
That's true. I tell you, it does play some tricks on you emotionally, though, when you're watching these two guys duke it out and – I don't even know who to root for. Yeah. I'm torn. I want them to both be successful, you know?
Like they punch each other at the same time and both knock each other out?
And that'd be a good day for me, you know? So, yeah, it is a tricky dynamic and something I've had to get used to for sure. So, and our whole team for that matter.
Awesome. Max, any other questions?
No, it's pretty awesome. We've got a fantastic facility here and it's pretty cool to see, you know, like just the level of detail that you guys are going into with everything. You know, sometimes you come into the facility and you kind of look at it and you're not sure if it's going to be, you know, like a strength and conditioning in some kind of like university where you're like a lot of it's for fluff, but the like what you were describing to us, like the hospital stuff, the diagnostic stuff, like it's incredible.
Yeah, seems like you guys are nailing it. Pretty, pretty
one thing good. That I've learned
this might turn into something.
Yeah,
who knows?
Yeah. One thing I've learned that with coming to this company, and it's something that the executive team said to us when we first got onboarded, is that when the UFC does something, they definitely don't go half-assed. Yeah. So, and that has been evident from watching how they put events on to how. They organize, you know, gatherings for the fighters, whether it be, you know, the retreat weekends and things like that, to just how, you know, they did a local event when we had the Maymack fight, where they brought a 300 square inch or something screen out on the amphitheater outside and hosted this big viewing party for, you know, people that didn't have tickets or whatever that were here. So they don't half-ass anything. That's pretty evident. When they go in all the way. So for that matter, when it comes to resources for us, if we just justify and show why we need something, they're like, all right, pull the trigger. So, you know, it's just up to us right now kind of figuring out what that is and making sure that it's whatever it is going to be influential over the performance of the fighters.
All right. Well, this was the Jug Life Podcast, another episode. If you enjoyed it, go on iTunes, give us a 5-star review, write us something funny or nice, and maybe I'll read it right here on the air, and you could win a free shirt or something. Like RoseDower85, who says, "The Jug Life is my go-to source of lifting information. Getting a notification about a new episode generates essentially the same feeling as finding out you're going to be a parent, I assume." And I hope for your future kids' sake, RoseDower85, that they don't read this. But if you're looking for unbelievable amounts of humor and attractiveness to boot, you've come to the right place. So thank you. Send me an email, chat@jtsstrength.com. We'll get you out something as a thank you for that. Go give us a good review so more people can find The Jug Life. We've got a couple upcoming events. Marissa and I will be in Australia, Brisbane on the 11th, Canberra on the 13th and 14th of March, and Melbourne on the 16th. You can sign up for those at store.jtsstrength.com. And then Max and I will be in New York at JDI Barbell on March 23rd and Outlift Athletics on March 24th for Jug Life Live. You can also find those in the events section at store.jtsstrength.com. If you're interested in online coaching for powerlifting, weightlifting, super total, or our new power building program, find out more about those at juggernautcoaching.com. And as always, we are proud of the content we produce here on YouTube. Thanks to the world's strongest videographer, Shorty Sedang. 3 videos a week, Tuesdays, Thursdays, Saturdays. Make sure you set some sort of notifications. That's probably a thing that you can do on YouTube.
Yeah.
YouTube will let you know that we had a new video. And you can go check those out and find The Jug Life on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, iHeartRadio, and thejuglife.com. Bo, if they want to learn more about you, find you on social media, stalk you in any way.
Sure. Instagram is bo.sandoval.
Creative.
That's me. That's my marketability right there. Twitter is Oly Strength, so Oly Strength. But I throw my email out there too. So anybody in the MMA community has questions around the PI or anything, it's bsandoval@ufc.com. I try to get back to my email as quick as I can. So if there's a little bit of delay, don't get discouraged, but I'll definitely get back to you.
You can find me on Instagram, max_ada. Or Facebook. And if you have any questions about the online coaching, you can email me max@jtsstrength.com.
And I'm Chad Wesley Smith, at Chad Wesley Smith and at Juggernaut Training on Facebook and Instagram, filling up your news feed all day. This was another episode of the Jug Life Podcast. Thanks for watching or listening, hopefully both. And we'll see you next week.